Hey, welcome back from Taste of TechEd. This is Rick Claus here at TechEd with a good friend of mine, Jeff Woolsey. And, you know, I managed to corner him. He got 15 minutes of fame on the keynote yesterday talking about virtualization. And I know there's a very long backstory about all the sort of stuff that went on during the keynote. But before we get into that, I just wanted to say and remind you and also remind the audience, obviously, we are live. If you do have any questions, you're welcome to go off and tweet to CH9Live. On Twitter, for those that happen to do any kind of tweeting. But you know, for those that don't know you and you know have just seen the keynote for you and the stuff that you did with the hypervisor, with virtual machines and everything else along that route, tell me a little tiny bit about your background.
So I'm part of a team, a whole bunch of us have actually been working on virtualization for a long time. I've had the pleasure of working on it for over 15 years. Way back before Microsoft, worked at a small company. Back then, people wanted to run DOS and Windows 3.1 on their Power Mac 6100 and 7100. So not only was it virtualization, but it was actually binary translation as well. So it was x86 to PowerPC and back and forth.
Oh, nice.
And so, yeah, so we did that on the Mac. Then we also, of course, did virtual PC for Mac and Windows, virtual server. Of course, now we've been focusing for many, many years now, Hyper-V as part of Server 2008, Server 2008 R2. And now, really, the culmination of many years of work, really, Server 2012 Hyper-V. In addition, we do a lot of work in terms of interoperability, mm-hmm. such as Linux integration and making sure that Linux has runs really, really well on top of Hyper-V. I'm sure we'll get to that as well. And really working in the industry to make sure that people have the ability to plug in and take advantage of all of the extensibility points for Hyper-V. I'm sure we're going to have a lot to talk about there. But there's a lot of opportunity with what we're doing in Server 2012 with Hyper-V, and really anxious to get to it today.
Oh, absolutely. And the first thing I want to talk about is you mentioned this thing that happened to be called non-virtualizable workloads. That's quite a mouthful to say. And obviously you rattled off a whole slew of these different stats as far as size, capacity, memory sort of stuff. I'm going to put you to the test here.
Yeah.
How fast can you say all those stats and make them meaningful?
Well, let me not only say all those stats, but let me provide you a little bit of context because it's actually great. I was here last year at TechEd, and I'll never forget, you know, folks coming by the booth saying, look, we're virtualizing today. We're doing it on Server 2008 R2 Hyper-V. We love what we're doing. We're getting fantastic performance. We're getting fantastic scale. But there were a couple of things that kept people from virtualizing certain workloads.
Mm-hmm.
And in the back of my mind, I was like, yeah, I know what we're working on. But tell me what it is.
Taking notes on business cards.
And we've done a lot of pre-planning up front. And we knew, you know, we had a great idea of what our customers were looking for. But when we look at, you know, what people are not virtualizing today, you know, you can characterize it in a number of different ways. Mm-hmm. Scale has always been one of them. You know, I need crazy amounts of CPU horsepower, memory capacity, storage capacity, and also the big one is IOPS. So, you know, we've taken a huge leap forward in Server 2012 with support for 64 virtual processors.
Right. So that's one tick box.
That's one tick box right off there.
You got one.
In terms of memory, now a full terabyte of memory. So now each virtual machine supports up to a full terabyte of memory. So
we're talking guests here.
We're talking guests. We're talking in the VM.
I can't imagine what you'd want to have a terabyte of RAM for.
Well,
in the first
you know,
place,
like I said, the goal here is to remove any blockers.
Yeah.
I've even had a couple of people say, really? Do people have workloads that big? I'll be honest with you, not a lot of them. Okay. The workloads are definitely getting larger. We're seeing definitely more in the 256 to 512 gigabyte class.
Mm-hmm.
Up to a terabyte, you know what? In a year, maybe you'll come back and there's more. But what we want to do is provide plenty of headroom, so we'll support up to a full terabyte of memory per VM.
Mm-hmm.
On the physical server, so we'll actually support up to 4 terabytes of memory on the physical server.
Okay.
Now, you're talking about a very large server. You're
yes.
not going to find this in, you know, most servers aren't going to have the ability to even take 4 terabytes of memory.
I've already asked my boss to be able to get one to have as a footstool beneath my desk, but
yeah.
She flatly rejected it.
Yeah, I'd
that,
like to have one of these in my office. No. takes up a little bit of room. You need
yes.
a lot of DIMMs, a lot of DIMM sockets, but we support up to full 4 terabytes of memory on the physical server. So 320 logical processors on the host, 4 terabytes on the host, 64 virtual processors within the VM, up to 1 terabyte within the VM. So now we start talking about one of the interesting things. So we got scale covered.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, what's interesting is I can give you all the scale, but if I don't give you the IOPS, it really doesn't matter. I mean, if I give you 64 virtual procs, 1 terabyte of memory, but on IOPS, you're not actually feeding all of those resources, it really doesn't matter. So one of the things we did was we spent a lot of time focusing on IOPS with storage and networking. And if in the keynote yesterday, Had the pleasure of showing off some of the great work that we've been doing in terms of IOPS, and delivered over 985,000 IOPS out of a single VM.
Yeah, that was huge.
Okay, out of a single VM, not the host, I'm talking one VM delivered 985,000 IOPS.
Now, okay, it didn't quite reach the number that I thought it was going to reach, because it would have been a nicer soundbite to roll off the tongue.
Yes.
Can
we do a million?
Well, I was going to say, can we do a million? Is
Absolutely.
It possible? And how does that compare to other people that are doing virtualization?
Can we do over a million IOPS out of a single VM? Yes, we absolutely can.
You heard it here.
Yes.
We can do over a million.
We can absolutely do over 1 million IOPS out of a single VM. Basically, the hardware we had, it was going as fast as it can.
Oh, yeah?
Quite honestly, the hardware doesn't go any faster.
They're SSD drives, right?
They're SSD.
So
let me tell you about the hardware, because it's actually a significant amount of hardware. To do 985,000 IOPS is a crazy amount of hardware. First of all, the server itself was an industry standard 4-socket server with 80 logical processors. Okay? On top of that, it had 256 gigabytes of physical memory. It had 5 LSI host bus adapters.
Mm-hmm.
5 LSI host bus adapters.
There's no more room left in this box.
Yeah, exactly. We run out of room. There's no more HBA room. And that was attached to 40 SSDs. Now, the reason why we use SSDs is we absolutely could have done this with spinning media, rotating mm-hmm. media. We could have done it with 15K SAS disks. For us to do this with 15K SAS disks, we would have needed 4,000 15K SAS disks. Okay, so wrap your head around that for just a moment. To put that in context, that's 10 full-size 42U racks full of disks.
I've seen the backstage at the keynote. It is not that large to be able to accommodate all that.
It's just,
sure.
it's a crazy amount of hardware. It's a crazy amount of power. And so we could have absolutely done it on spinning media, but just to make things a little easier, we went with 40 SSDs.
Okay.
So instead of 4,000, 40.
Yeah.
But we could have done it as well on that. So we were able to get over 985,000. Now again, that was the limit of the hardware. If we were on a bigger server with more HBAs and more SSDs, Hyper-V actually has plenty of headroom to go higher.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the SSDs we were using are 3-year-old SSDs. One of the guys who actually runs it was the first one to tell me, he's like, Jeff, these are actually pretty old. These are far from the state of the art. In fact, there's much faster SSDs out there on the market right now. So you can expect to see that number's only going to go up.
Okay.
But Hyper-V, the point I want to make is Hyper-V doesn't have a limit. We haven't hit one yet. That's how big and how much we're providing in terms of IOPS and performance in Hyper-V. Mm-hmm. So we've got that covered. And then on the networking side, we've also done some really amazing things. We now have SRIOV, which is single root IO virtualization. And what that allows us to do is actually to map network devices into virtual machines. So all of a sudden now, a VM, instead of going through the normal switch, it can actually talk directly to the physical hardware on the data plane. And essentially, you can now get greater than line rate performance out of a 10 gig NIC from a VM. And you don't give up live migration. You can still live migrate that with VM with SRIOV.
So all this scale, addressing what you call the non-virtualizable workloads, this sort of stuff. How did you guys come up with where this was going to be coming from? Was there a different development process that comes up? Because you're speccing stuff out that is yet to be required.
So yes.
Talk to me a little bit about the dev process, the thinking behind how we got to where we are right now. And I doubt you can share where we're going in the future.
I certainly can't do that.
Because we're not done with where we are right now.
Yes, so. First of all, our job number one right now is from RC to RTM.
Oh, yeah.
Right now, all we're doing is making sure that everything's ready, and we are absolutely right now green light, and we're working on all of our testing and final validation. Mm-hmm. But that's all we are focused on right now, and that's all we'll talk about. But the dev process, we really went through an extensive planning process before this release.
Okay.
Before Server 2012, we spent over a year in what we call a pre-planning process. And in that process, we basically said, we want to go out and spend time talking directly to all of our customers. Small customers, medium business, enterprise, government, financial, you name it, all around the world. In fact, I read a quote from Bill Lang, our vice president for server, where he quoted as saying, we spent over $10 million just on pre-planning. And the goal here was we wanted to be crystal clear on the plan. We wanted to make sure we knew with absolute certainty, what is it our customers want?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can look through every single new feature in Hyper-V, and there are literally hundreds of new features in Hyper-V. Every one of them is driven by a customer. There's no feature, and not just Hyper-V, in server all up, If you look at server, every feature in there is driven by a customer need, a customer requirement, a customer demand. There's no features in there that are in there because a developer thought it was cool.
Okay, good.
There's no features in there because a PM thought, oh, let's put that checkbox in there because it's cool. Everything was driven by a customer, and that's what we made sure we delivered. And it's not about following what anybody else is doing, because we've done things that nobody else is doing, such as, for example, shared nothing live migration. Shared Nothing Live Migration is a feature that has been met with just resounding applause from all of our customers, industry analysts. The fact that you can live migrate a VM between two servers with nothing but an Ethernet cable is just something our customers are just thrilled about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we wanted to make sure that we understand their core requirements. And around VM mobility, it was, really, I want to be able to move a VM anywhere. Make it as easy as possible. And features like Share Nothing Live Migration is a perfect example of that.
Absolutely. I'm just going to take a break here for a second just to remind people again, you can take some questions live if you like with tweeting CH9 Live anytime you like. I got a couple up on the board there. You can see them over there. I'll let you pick, actually, if you wanted to pick any one of those three just to kind of start, just to put you on the spot.
Oh, okay. There's a question here about host USB support in Hyper-V.
Right. That's some good old Kevin Remedy.
Yes. So one of the things, let me kind of talk about, actually let me go back to VM mobility and kind of explain how this relates to USB.
Okay.
So one of the things our customers were adamant about was VM mobility. They very much told us, you cannot do anything that precludes live migration. Mm-hmm. In fact, one example I would always point out is we talk with customers and I'd say, look, I have a feature I can give you. It's a cool new feature, feature X. And if I give you this cool new feature, by the way, this VM can no longer move. I can't live migrate it. I can't live storage migrate it. I can't fail over to another server.
You lose control of it.
This VM is now locked to this piece of hardware.
Yeah.
How do you feel about feature X? And whenever I asked this question, the answer was always, oh, we want you to take feature X and we want you to bury it out back and never talk about it again. Because live migration and mobility is paramount. In fact, we want you to optimize for that. When it comes to USB, once you start mapping a physical USB device into a VM, the mobility of that VM can become compromised. Mm-hmm. So we've actually looked at solving USB in a different way, which is to add new capabilities and enhancements to RDP. So for example, if you're remoting into a virtual machine, RDP will use RDP to redirection to include your USB devices.
Okay.
And in fact, we now support a much larger laundry list. Pretty much your USB devices, your phones, all of your devices now can be used RDP redirection into a VM so that you get the ability to map USB devices into a VM and you can still live migrate the VM around. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you're in a VDI scenario and you're using a personalized desktop and you've got a USB device that's plugged into that VM, and on the back end, that VM gets live migrated to another server, it still continues to work.
Through
so you get
RDP
the best
connection.
Of both worlds. Yes. So that's how we do that.
Okay. Now, before we take another question from the Twitter side of things, there's one thing I wanted to bring up again about the, it was kind of tied into the keynote demo a little bit, but it was about specifically the ODX environment. For those of you that don't know what ODX is, I wonder if you could just explain it a little bit.
Yeah.
And is it something that's only unique to Hyper-V for what we're doing?
So ODX, offloaded data transfer. So this is a huge shout out to the storage team and to our storage partners. This has really been an industry-wide initiative, and honestly, our storage vendors, our storage partners, they've been fantastic to work, and we have a fantastic solution, offloaded data transfer. Really, the goal with ODX is for Windows Server to leverage the capabilities in your SAN array. So let's assume for a second, this is my SAN array. Today, if I need to copy a file from here to here, with Windows Server, what'll happen is, I will read from here and write to here. Read and write. And the server does all the transactions. It's reading and writing, so there's I/O that's going on. Obviously, there's memory utilization, there's CPU utilization. And in fact, in the keynote demo, I showed that we were actually doing a copy and we completely pegged gigabit Ethernet.
Yeah.
So gigabit Ethernet was completely saturated. CPU had gone up to about 40%. We were getting about 70 megabytes per second throughput. So we were getting great performance.
Yes.
And the server was doing the copy and it was really doing well. But that's how we normally do it. With offloaded data transfer, what we're doing is we're actually offloading. We're taking advantage of the SAN to do the copy and the offload for us. Mm-hmm. So a server 2012 will actually go to the array and say, array, do you support this? In fact, let me take a moment to say, it's actually not even just the array. In server 2012, the server 2012 file server also supports ODX. So if you're taking advantage of our new really awesome file server in Server 2012, it also takes advantage of ODX.
Oh, wow.
So in Server 2012, again, here's how ODX works. We call to the storage device, whether it's a SAN array or the file server. It comes back and says, do you support ODX? And the storage returns, why, yes, I do. Fantastic. Here's a secure token. Please perform this copy for me. And give me a couple of status updates to let me know how the copying is happening, but you do the copy. So what ends up happening is, instead of me doing the read and write to the server, the array or the storage device, in the case of the file server as well, will perform the copy. So instead of all of this I/O, there's literally no I/O going on between the server and the array. Mm-hmm. So yesterday when I did the demo in the keynote, you could see we were saturating the gigabit Ethernet. When we did this with ODX, there's no I/O. So all of a sudden we freed up all of this I/O that would normally be going on. And in fact, instead of, and the performance, we were getting a gigabyte per second. Let me say that one more time. Not a gigabit, a gigabyte per second. So we copied a 10 gigabyte file in 10 seconds and offloaded data transfer. Like I said, it's supported in the Windows file server in Server 2012, and it's supported by our partners in their storage appliances, storage devices, SAN arrays.
That's insane. That's like what? That's a DVD in 5 seconds.
It's a DVD in 5 seconds.
That's insane. Absolutely insane. How did you pick all the different stuff you're going to be trying to cover in the 15 minutes? We have taken more than 50 minutes so far, and we're still only scratching the surface. Like, how did you pick the different stuff that you're going to be talking about in the keynote?
This is actually one of the biggest problems that we have with Server 2012. Server 2012 is just rich across the board. And just a huge shout out to, number one, our customers. We heard all of your feedback. This release is for you. Okay, everything that you asked about, everything you wanted to see, we made sure we prioritize everything based on your feedback. Whether it's storage, whether it's networking, whether it's the hypervisor, whether it's automation, whether it's manageability, you name it, whether it's scale, we looked at the entire server in its totality. One of the biggest mistakes is to get completely focused on the hypervisor. Mm-hmm. This is where I live and breathe. I love what we're doing at Hyper-V. But the platform for cloud is much broader than that.
Okay.
The work that we do, offloaded data transfer is a perfect example. I mean, look at the investments we've made in storage. Look at the investments we've made in the file server. The file server is tremendous. And in fact, here's a perfect example. I was ready to show a really cool example, a demo in the keynote yesterday with the scale-out file server. And quite literally, we just didn't have enough time.
Mm-hmm.
And I really mean it when I was talking in the keynote, the fact that there's just not enough time. I mean, we're going to be talking about Windows Server all week, and there's just too much to cover. It's one of the biggest challenges we have is there's so much, it's such a feature-rich release, that how do we actually express everything new in Server 2012 in a way that people can grok? So we're kind of trying to do it in little bits and pieces. We've been blogging extensively. Please, make sure you take a look at the Windows Server blog. You'll see posts by everyone in the storage team, the networking team, the UX team, PowerShell, automation, Hyper-V. It's really a concerted effort throughout all of Windows Server and Windows itself, mm-hmm. because literally you can't just sit down in 1 week and get it all.
Yep. I mean, I think they announced the new server core blogging hub that actually aggregates all this sort of stuff up from server and tools.
Yes.
I know Jeffrey Snover has been doing some great work.
Jeffrey Snover.
Curating
yes.
the articles as they go through. And
yes.
then internally, I see a lot of the review process that goes on. So it's awesome the amount of information that's coming out that's around server 2012.
Really positive, yes.
It's insane. Now, one thing I know I absolutely wanted to find out, because you need to explain the difference to me for this one, is we now have the virtual switch inside the extensible virtual switch
yes.
inside Server 2012. You showed one from, there was the Cisco.
I showed the Cisco Nexus 1000V yesterday, yes.
So talk to me a bit about, you know, why, as an admin of an environment that is based on Hyper-V, why should I really care about the extensible switch? And you know, if I'm just worried about plugging some networks in, and you did some quality of service stuff that's mm-hmm. on there, is that all that it can do, or is there more to it? Is this being taken on by partners?
That was just the super, super tip top of the iceberg, what I showed off yesterday. So when we developed Server 2012, one of the things that became very clear to us was there's a lot of different environments with a lot of different networking requirements based on those environments.
Mm-hmm.
In a branch office, you know what, maybe a simple unmanaged switch is all you're looking for, okay? Maybe in a medium environment, maybe you'd like to put in some things that would help you with antivirus, some things you could kind of set and forget. In an enterprise where you've got physical switches galore, you've got lots of servers and hosts galore, and you want to be able to manage those individual virtual switches in a consistent manner to your physical switches, there's three different environments. And then when you get to data, you know, data centers running massive clouds, you know, there's a lot of different scenarios here. So we looked at this in a couple of different ways. Number one, we wanted to do a lot more in the built-in switch. So the virtual switch itself has taken a dramatic leap forward. We've added a whole bunch of new capabilities. We've always had support for VLANs in there, but now we have support for PVLANs as well. We've also added a whole bunch of things in terms of security to help protect against rogue DHCP servers, to protect against rogue routers that are VMs that are pretending to be routers. We've also done a number of things around performance and scale. So we've added SRIOV, we've added dynamic virtual machine queue. So a whole bunch of things that impact performance and scale. Also, one really important capability is quality of service. So one of the things people want to be able to do is they want to be able to provide bandwidth quality of service. Lots of times for a service provider where they have to meet a service level agreement, you need to be able to provide that quality of service because you have a contract with a customer to deliver to a specific quality guarantee. So quality of service is a key capability that's simply built right into the Hyper-V switch. But at the same time, while we did a whole bunch of work into the switch itself, we knew we couldn't be all things to all people. We could make this super, super crazy, extensible, super rich, and all of a sudden it could be, you know, too much for a small and medium environment. Or there could be just something that, you know, is only needed in a specific, for a specific role or a specific scenario that not everyone really needs a feature for. So we wanted to make it open and extensible. This allows our partners to augment the virtual switch and to do all sorts of interesting things. So for example, in the case of the Cisco Nexus 1000, if you're in a data center, if you're a Cisco shop, and you're already using Cisco physical switches, and you want to manage your Cisco virtual switches in a consistent manner, use the Nexus 1000V for Hyper-V. You're all set. Now you've got a simple way to manage all of your Cisco Nexus and your Hyper-V switch and your virtual and your physical switches in a consistent manner.
Because you were using actually the Cisco 1000 tool to be able to manage that switch that was there. So that's a very easy, seamless transition.
Absolutely. Sure. And the network admins love it because they use their existing tools. There's nothing to relearn and it just works.
So you also mentioned that other partners are also making different plugins or different switches to be able to fit in this. Can you have a couple examples you want to?
Yes, there's a couple. A great one is our partners over at Five9.
Yep.
So Five9 saw the value in the extensible switch really early on and jumped on, and they're developing and demonstrating a virtual firewall that plugs right into the extensible switch. So because we've designed the switch to be extensible and you can plug in at different parts of the switch, there's ideal points for port forwarding, for example, for Cisco Nexus 1000 or for OpenFlow, for example. Our partners at NEC are working on OpenFlow implementation, which is actually very popular in Europe and in Asia. And in addition, we've got Five9 that's working on virtual firewall. I'm pretty sure they're demonstrating here, as well as S-Flow by Inmon. So we've got those, and there's plenty of others that are demonstrating here at the Tech Expo, and you'll be hearing more about those over time, but we've got a long list of partners that are already developing, have either announced or are soon going to be announcing more plugins for the extensible switch. So even here at the release candidate stage at RC, we've already got a half dozen folks that have signed up that are plugged into the extensible switch, and that number is expected to double very, very soon. So what we're seeing is driving an open ecosystem around what's going on in the extensible switch and providing lots of flexibility and choice. And that gets really, really interesting as we start to do more software-defined networking.
Coming back to the Twitter wallets over there, if you want to take a look, let's take a look. We happen to have one there. How about New Wind Server 2012 have any sort of ability to allow multipath TCP for allowing good utilization of storage bandwidth? Are they talking about NIC teaming or multipath IO from within the guest system?
I'm gonna interpret that in a couple different ways, so I'll answer this in a couple of different ways. So number one, if you look at what we've done in the file server, so in the Windows Server 2012 file server, we have the new SMB3 protocol.
Yep.
And one thing I want to really encourage everyone to look at, I'm going to take a moment to talk about the file server for just a second. If you've ever configured and set up and used a Windows file server, take everything you know and pretty much toss it out the window. This is a brand new file server. This is not your grandfather's file server. We've already demonstrated performance, pretty some earth-shattering performance with the new file server in Server 2012. We actually have the classic file server that you're used to configuring, which has all sorts of new rich capabilities.
Yep.
For example, deduplication. okay, if you have a whole bunch of unstructured data, and honestly, who doesn't on a file server, guess what? Deduplication is now in the box. So we'll dedupe your data. We also have thin provisioning in the box. So we'll allocate your storage on demand. That capability is all built into the file server. In terms of performance, we've made some massive changes to the SMB protocol itself. There's a reason it's called SMB 3 and not SMB 2.2 or 2.5 or 2 dot something. It's because this is a big release. We made some major changes to the protocol. One of them was around multi-channel. In the past, for example, SMB did pretty okay. SMB 2.x was pretty okay on gigabit. But when you start to move to 10 gigabit, it wasn't very good about saturating. And in fact, SMB would open up a single channel. With SMB 3.0, we actually have multi-channel. So what happens is if you've got the bandwidth, we'll create multi-channel, utilize that bandwidth, and all of a sudden, your performance skyrockets and scales with your available bandwidth. So SMB multi-channel, a key capability, and that's also built into the file server.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's an industry standard, we've also been working with our storage partners to implement SMB 3, and we want to make sure that the entire industry is doing so. This is an important thing because I didn't realize this until really recently, how many people were shipping still SMB 1.0, 1.x implementations, and my head almost exploded, quite honestly. Take a look. I've talked to some people in the past, and SMB has kind of, there's some interesting, perception about SMB and performance. And yeah, if you're using a 20-year-old protocol,
I think there'd be some performance issues for sure.
It's not going to be working as well on the latest and greatest in hardware. And SMB 3 is a dramatic step forward.
Yeah.
In addition, of course, we have multipath I/O, and multipath I/O works great for iSCSI, and it works great for redundancy and load and failover for storage I/O.
You know what? Let's have a little bit of fun. How about this one here? Min shell, server core, or full GUI? If you had to choose between those three, and you're on a desert island, and you have a couple Hyper-V servers, and you need to configure them, how would you configure those two Hyper-V servers?
So I better explain to everybody what this means, first of all, because people may not understand what core, min shell, and full actually means. Let me do that really quickly.
Yeah.
So we've actually made some big changes into how you can deploy Server 2012 now. One of the things we really want to do is encourage people to deploy and manage remotely. Okay? The days of going to a server, going to the GUI, TSing to the box, and actually managing on the box, those need to go away now. It's time. Okay? We've done all of the plumbing. We have all the rich management. We have just dropped in literally a V12 automation engine in PowerShell. Everything you want to do for remote management is all in the box now with V12, no more excuses.
Mm-hmm.
So in Server 2008 R2, when you install it, at install time you're presented an option. Do I want to install as core, or do I want to install in a full GUI? And it's an installation option. And when you get to core, if you choose core, you install Server 2008 R2, you're presented with a command prompt.
Right.
That's it. And I will be very transparent. It's a challenging thing to do. It absolutely can be done, but there's some challenges in doing that. And then you can do full on 2008 R2, but if you decide you want to go back and forth, that's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
You set it at install time, and it's a one chance to set it. In 2012, it's so much different. Number one, it's now configurable. So you can now install full Server 2012 with the GUI, configure the system, do all the things you want to do, get all your drivers installed, do whatever you need to do, and when you're done, uninstall the shell. No more GUI. You can go back to just a command prompt and now do all your management remotely.
I think it's only like two PowerShell commands or something like that.
It's real simple.
Yeah.
You can do it via PowerShell, or you can go into the GUI and say, hey, get rid of all of this stuff and reboot, and all of a sudden you're back to a command prompt. And what's nice about this is I know that there's still going to be some people that are hesitant to run with a minimal command line interface,
mm-hmm.
if they even need to, because you really shouldn't need to anymore. You can do all this remotely.
Yep.
But if you feel you really need to and you want to go back to the server, you can go back and enable the GUI. There's a couple PowerShell commandlets, reboot, and all of a sudden the GUI's back.
Okay.
So what we want to do is, the reason why we did it in this way is we want to provide a bridge to make it easier for people to kind of make the jump from running at the full interface to running to managing remotely. And in Server 2008 R2, there really wasn't that bridge there. It was kind of like an either or, and you either made the transition or if you didn't.
Yep.
And we want to make it a lot easier now.
Okay.
In addition, we also have this middle ground this min shell, this minimal server interface, which is actually a middle ground. This actually, I really like this one a lot. This is actually, I actually run this one in my office quite a bit. It's not the full install. What you actually do is you uninstall and it installs the shell, Internet Explorer, pretty much everything except Server Manager. So the Server Manager, and it's, if you haven't seen the Server Manager in Server 2012, it's this beautiful Metro interface, very easy. It's actually presents a lot more dashboard interface information. One of the things that our folks in the management team and the UX team, we heard from our customers is, you know, if I do have to go to the server, because maybe I'm in a small and a medium environment, I don't have a lot of servers, and I haven't invested in systems management yet, I'd like to be able to walk up to the server and get immediate status of the server. You know, I log in and immediately I have green light, green light, green light, red light. Ooh, I better go take a look at red light. Server Manager gives you that instant dashboard now. So I like the Server Manager, and so I actually like this middle interface. Again, this is in my office where I'm only running a few servers, so you know, this makes a lot of sense. But in this case, I literally can walk up to a server and, oh, I see a red light, what's going on here? Oh, I'm low on disk. Okay, I need to plug in another disk and get some more storage. Or, oh, you know what? I'm low on this resource. Or, you know what? I forgot to do X. And it'll give you best practices built in the server now. We've now put best practice analyzer. We put a whole bunch of helps and tips and tricks into Server Manager to help all of our IT pros. So there's core, which is just the command prompt. There's full, which is the rich Windows Server experience as you expect today. And there's this new minimal server interface, which is literally just the Server Manager and a command prompt. And so I like that one a whole bunch. I know that was a super long answer.
It was a long answer
for
which one you're going
to
do for a desert island. So I'm assuming your answer will be
my answer is here's my thing. If I was on a desert server and you said desert island, you said I had two servers.
Yeah.
I'd actually go with that one. Okay. If I was in an enterprise where I'm going to be doing everything via System Center, then I'm going to run core, and I'm going to manage everything remotely with System Center.
Okay.
If I'm on a desert island on one server, guess what? I'm going to go with the full. So there you go.
It's a good point. We have a question up there from Jeff Alexander. Trying to see if it's there from the Twitter side of
things.
Does
the SMIS provider have poor performance? Wow, Jeff, that's a very pointed question. Honestly, I seriously doubt it, but I am not the SMIS guru, and I can't even speak to it. So I'm sorry. I would have to point you to some of our storage management guys.
And well, it was worth trying it. Worth trying out.
No, again, it's okay. What I would tell you is we've actually done a tremendous amount of work in the industry. In terms of the SMB 3.0 protocol, a whole bunch of work we're doing around standards-based management for storage, and you're going to only see massive improvement in that area. Honestly, I'd be really surprised if there was poor performance, because right now, between beta and RTM, that's where we're actually doing a whole bunch of performance optimizations.
Right, and it's the last stage before we go to the RTM, so that's good. Reminder, once again, we are live. We still have the ability to take some more questions for a couple more minutes. CH9 Live is the way to get a hold of us up here if you want to ask us anything. I was going to ask you a little bit about your sessions, because I'm assuming you got a relatively full speaking slate while you're here.
Yes, it's been pretty busy.
And you did a two-part session yesterday, I do believe.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about those ones, because those will be available online.
There's something
I got
to tell
right?
you about.
Well, this online on demand, people can go back and take a look at these sessions at northamerica.msteched.com, and they'll be able to be streamed off of the channel line infrastructure. And talk to me about your session, man.
So I had a great couple sessions yesterday. Did the keynote and had a little bit of time, a little downtime, and got prepped and reared up and ready to go and did my two sessions. And the feedback has just been fantastic. Number one, it's clear that everybody gets Server 2012. When I ask folks how many folks were using the RC, you know, people just, they're like, oh yeah, we've been looking, kicking the tires on Server 2012 since early on. We're exceptionally happy with what's in this release, and we're here to get all the information, because the question is not if we're going to deploy it. The question is, like, how soon are we going to deploy it? Are we going to deploy it the day RTM, or are we going to wait a week? It's a feature-rich solution. Everyone's kicking the tires on it. We expect we're going to see a really fast uptake for this release, so we're very excited about that. I also had the pleasure of actually letting the world in on a little secret. So, in addition to Hyper-V and Windows Server 2012, we actually have this little product on the side, very quietly. My team kind of works on this one. It's called Microsoft Hyper-V Server. We've actually been shipping Microsoft Hyper-V Server for a couple of years. And yep. Microsoft Hyper-V Server is our standalone hypervisor. It's just the hypervisor. It's a free download. You can go right now, www.microsoft.com, I think it's HVS, and download it. It's a free download. And we've had Microsoft Hyper-V Server 2008. We had Microsoft Hyper-V Server 2008 R2. And we've just announced yesterday for the first time Microsoft Hyper-V Server 2012. Again, this is our free hypervisor. Nice. So what's in the free hypervisor and why would I want to use it? Well, first of all, let me tell you why we've been developing this. Number one, people love Hyper-V. And when you buy Hyper-V, generally, if you buy, for example, Windows Server Data Center Edition, you get unlimited copies of Windows because we include that in the license.
Right.
So people like it, and they stack it up. They put a whole bunch of Windows on it. And they want to run Linux on it because we actually been doing a great job in terms of Linux support on Hyper-V. We support Red Hat, SUSE, CentOS, NeoKylin, and we're working on additional distributions to support on Hyper-V. And in fact, we've been including our Linux distro drivers into the kernel. It's now in the mainline kernel as GPL for a few years now. So we've been doing a lot of work and investment there. And so people said, but if I want to run Linux on Windows Server, it uses one of those Windows slots for the license. So is there kind, you know, you include Hyper-V as part of Windows. Is there a, you know, kind of a free way for me to run Linux on Hyper-V? And so Microsoft Hyper-V Server is a great way to do that because it's a free product and you can run Linux on it as well. In addition, if you're doing VDI, so if you're actually doing VDI deployments and you want to deploy clients in this environment, certainly you can use Windows Server. It works fantastic in Hyper-V. But you're using clients, so there's actually no licensing impact. You still have to buy client licenses for it. So Microsoft Hyper-V Server is perfect for that because it's completely free. And then lastly, and this is kind of a silly one, but it's very true, I've had a number of folks say, you know, I'd like to have a Hyper-V layer that literally my IT admins, it kind of prevents them from doing bad behavior, like browsing the web, okay? I know IT admins know they shouldn't be doing this, but too often we catch them doing things like, hey, I'm browsing the web or I'm downloading things on, you're on a server, what are you doing? Okay, you should be running remotely anyways.
Yep.
So Hyper-V Server helps enforce that behavior because there's no shell, there's no GUI, there's no IE, there's literally just the command prompt. The whole goal of Hyper-V Server is that you install it, you manage it remotely. And you can manage it remotely using our free tools, the remote server administration tools, or you can manage it with System Center, or you could manage it with PowerShell. So PowerShell's free, System Center obviously you have to pay for, but the remote server administration toolkit is completely free. So you can do all of your thing here for free. So that's kind of why we've delivered it and why we're developing it. So let me tell you what's in Microsoft Hyper-V Server 2012. 64 virtual processors per VM, 4 terabytes of physical memory, up to 320 logical processors.
Wait a second.
Up to 1 terabyte of memory per VM.
These are all the same.
The extensible switch, Hyper-V replica, NIC teaming.
It's everything that's in the full product, as far as the capabilities of the VMs.
Hyper-V is Hyper-V. Failover clustering, shared nothing live migration.
Wow.
Live storage migration is all in the box. And I shouldn't say box because it doesn't come in a box. It's a free download.
Downloadable ISO file for install.
So you look a little shocked over there, Rich. You okay there?
Well, I thought normally you'd put some kind of a restriction on what was in it before.
No, but restrictions are for the other guys. If you look at what the other guys have been doing, they've been actually reducing the functionality of their free product over time. We've been increasing the functionality of our free product. Mm-hmm. So let me say that one more time. This is the free product. No strings attached. I know, actually after I did this and I made this announcement in my session yesterday, everybody came up to me at the podium. I had 30, 40 people surrounding me trying to figure out what the catch was. They're like, but I need to buy something to manage this with. No, you can use the free remote administration toolkit. Okay, but I can't live migrate without System Center. No, you can live migrate with the remote administration toolkit. Okay, well what do I need to get 64 virtual processors? Nothing, it's in the box. Well, what do I need to get clustering? Nothing, it's in the box. What do I need to do shared nothing live migration? It's in the box. Again, it's in the download. I need to start saying in the download.
Yeah.
So Hyper-V Server 2012 release candidate is available right now.
It wasn't there for the beta release.
It wasn't.
That I remember seeing from the download SKUs.
Actually, I think it was in the beta. We just didn't make a lot of noise about it.
Okay.
It is available right now. You can download the Microsoft Hyper-V Server 2012 release candidate. It's available in the same place. We put all the downloads for all the Server 8, Client 8, Hyper-V Server, all of our SKUs are up there. And you'll see that Microsoft Hyper-V Server 2012 RC is up there as well.
That's incredible. You mentioned remote management with Hyper-V Server because obviously you have to be able to remotely manage it effectively. There's actually a question up there from Bosch Kobe that was asking, I'm going to kind of rephrase it a little bit, still kind of get the same kind of gist, but because we're working in this remote environment, are we doing stuff to work with our partners to make it so that their products that run on top of the servers that may be virtualized, may not be virtualized, are having less of a dependency on GUI interfaces?
We've been telling people actually since Server 2008 that they need to make sure that their products and services can deploy in a headless manner.
That's true. It's the introduction of Server Core, right?
So. It's actually, there's a reason why we've been working on this steadily for many releases. We knew it wasn't going to be a single release because it takes time. We're talking about a very large paradigm shift in how you're doing deployments. And also it means we had a lot of work we had to do in terms of manageability to make sure we provided you the right solution to do remote management. But let me be very clear, in Server 2008, we told people, here's Core, and in fact, we've been telling our server vendors, make sure that you can run remotely and can be managed remotely, because we expect this is where we're taking people. At 2008 R2, we said the same thing. We told our server vendors, you need to make sure that you can run remotely, that you can manage and install remotely, you can do more things remotely. And in Server 2012, we are amping up that message again, and we're gonna make it even louder, because we wanna make sure that more and more people, by default, ask yourself, why am I actually putting a GUI on the server? It's actually about changing behavior. It's about not managing a server going to the box anymore. We're used to TSing to the box. You're already being to the box and doing that. And we understand why we're doing it, but we know it to do this at scale. You got to do this with automation. You got to do it with PowerShell.
Now, I guess one of the things that came up, just because you kind of clicked for me, is that if you end up with a server application that needs to be installed on a system and it's a Server Core install, you could always bring back the GUI, do the install configuration as you need to on the console, and then take it back out again.
You totally hit the nail on the head. That's why we wanted to provide this ability to go back and forth. Because you know what? You are going to run into that one guy who says, you know what? It actually can run remotely, but we have a specific problem with install, or there's this one thing we need to do locally. So great, install the GUI, do whatever you need to do to configure the system, uninstall the GUI and you're back. And now go back to remote management. So again, it's about providing that bridge to go back and forth, but I can certainly see it, you know, we're gonna make sure that we tell our application vendors, again, this is how you need to be deploying. I also see one more question I wanted to mention, which was will SMB3 be an open standard?
That's by A. Steve Cleary, yes.
Yes, it is. We've actually been working with the industry. In fact, huge props to our storage team. Our storage team went to the Samba folks, and we work with them to make sure they understand what they need to do and how they need to do it, because SMB3 is very much, we're putting a huge investment behind this. And the way to do it is to move and push the entire industry. And make sure that if you are looking at a file-based server, file-based storage solution, ask your storage vendor, does this support SMB3 and to what level? And if they say, no, this is an SMB2 device, then your answer is, great, when is there SMB3? And if the answer isn't like very, very soon, you need to keep your options open.
Wow.
Because SMB3 is a radical reshift for file-based storage. We made huge investments for scale, performance, and most important, for resiliency. You've got to make sure that if a TCP/IP connection goes down, or you have to all of a sudden you have some sort of outage, that you can effectively deal with resiliency and resilient handles, and make sure you cover all of the cases, and especially some persistent pathological corner cases that we found in earlier versions of SMB. SMB3, big investment here.
Awesome. We've got just under a minute left, so I just wanted to kind of wind things down a bit. It's been so great talking with you, Jeff. Honestly, I could keep on going on for hours, but my producer over there would probably start yelling in my ear, so I'm not going to go ahead and start doing that. Just coming up in a couple of moments, we will be cutting back over to Brian Keller and Cameron Skinner, talking about some more stuff with some Taste of Tech Ed here, actually, on the Channel 9 live stage. They're going to be coming back. But people want to go off and see more stuff from you. If you're interested, WSV_guy. He's After his session yesterday, he magically had like 300 or 400 new followers that started to come onto Twitter. Take a look at that. One of the prolific bloggers on the virtualization blog as well. Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you very much
for spending time with me on the stage. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And we'll be back soon. Thank you.